Future, of course, trying to stay vaguely close to the thing we're meeting at least at the time. So I want to start with instruments, and the idea here is, I know this is Theory Institute, but I guess I'm allowed to mention instruments sometimes. The idea is to give you some idea of the capabilities of the different instruments that exist. So this representation is an arbitrary one, but just showing them in terms of the photon energies that they measure and their field of view, which is one parameter which is very different. So most of what I'm going to talk about today are things on the ground, with one notable exception, which is the Large Area Telescope on the Fermi mission, which is in space. It's basically the only space and space mission that I'm going to discuss. Okay, there are people in the audience that know much more about Fermi than me, but I think this is a bit of a brick. Yeah, it's a big box flying in space. It's a pet production telescope with a wide field of view, which is just defined by the geometry of the thing, really. It's something like a square meter, and the observing pattern is to scan the sky in such a way, combined with the wide field of view, that any given object spends something like 10% of the time in the field of view. Okay? So you get an effective collection area of about 0.1 square meter for everything on the sky all the time. Now, down at the bottom end of the Fermi band, sort of hundreds of MeV domain. Background is an issue. Up at the kind of energies that we're talking about, it isn't, and you basically have to just wait for Fermi to collect enough photons. So if you can do a very simple calculation just to see what the flux limit should be at the high energy end, you basically conclude that if you allow yourself to live with one photon arriving every year, you get to a flux limit. Okay. So clearly, the high energy end, you're not going to be making good light curves with Fermi with one photon per year, but you build up a nice spectrum over time. Okay, the other thing that's nice at the high energy end is that you improve the angular resolution, something like a degree down here, it's 0.1 degree up here. But clearly, it's pretty limited at the high energy end for short time scale. Now, the things that are good at that are these ground-based instruments, which have much larger collection areas and very substantial backgrounds, so they become background-free again at very highest energies. But in the TeV domain, they have substantial background charge cuts and rays, impinging on the Earth's atmosphere. There are two different techniques at work here, hence the big difference in field of view. I'll mention both of them briefly. And just to explain why I'm focusing on this energy range. This is the energy range which is relevant for the topic of the meeting, in the sense that if I go down to GeV energies, gammas can cross the universe without that producing, so in a sense I don't care. And if I go to very, very high energies, then gamma rays won't even make it to me from the center of our own galaxy. So at some point, I stop having any information about extragalactic objects. So this is the energy range from something like a few tens of GeV to a few tens of TeV, which is probed by these instruments, which I'll give you. I don't know. Okay, so Christoph already explained this technique, so I will do it again for these ground-based imaging atmospheric Cherenkov telescopes. We also show a photograph of these things. I guess this will be a common theme, but Christoph already said this, right? Because your introductory talk is for all encompassing. But just to add a couple more bits of information, there are three major instruments. There are also a few small ones dotted around the world. They have different pros and cons. In the Northern Hemisphere, you have MAGIC and Veritas. MAGIC has a little bit lower energy threshold. But this is nice to have two instruments in the same hemisphere at different longitudes. It gives you better light curves, better statistics in general. In the Southern Hemisphere, we only have HESS. But HESS has now five telescopes, including this large central dish, 28-meter optical telescope, and this thing allows you to reach to down to sort of 20 GeV, so you can get wide spectral coverage. Okay, now what what do these things see? Well, switching back to Fermi for the moment, the Fermilab latest catalogue contains something like 3,000 sources. So by normal astronomical standards, this is not particularly an impressive feat. But what is interesting is the sheer variety of different phenomena that Fermi sees. Okay, so the stuff we're interested in here is up here, the active galaxies, various flavors, but there's a lot of other stuff as well that I just wanted to flash up. And interestingly, a lot of this variety is also reflected in the TV band. So what these are the ones with dashed white lines on are seen with these ground-based instruments. So the number of sources is much more limited, 175 at the moment, but the diversity is there. Okay, so this is telling you something about how common acceleration of particles to TeV energies is in nature, but it's not particularly unusual, and the subsequent radiation that, of course, of these high-energy photons by various processes. Okay, so the sky TeV energy was also shown briefly by Christoph. A couple of things to point out here. Most of the objects are in the galactic plane, but this is clearly biased towards the galactic plane because this is the only part of the sky that's really been systematically surveyed in the TeV domain. Okay. So if I do an unbiased survey of the TeV sky, I'm pretty sure that it's dominated again by active galaxies. The other thing that's taken from Christoph that I found intriguing earlier was that in your paper you corrected for the selection biases of the TeV blazar sample, which is an impressive feat given the sort of totally arbitrary criteria used to decide to point at all these things in the first place, right? So this is really a very biased catalog because it just depends on the three different consortia. They say this week I like the idea of this source, this week a different source. So it's hard to do really population study work based on this sample, I would say. And you can, of course, take the subset of these which were detected by accident, yes, serendipitously discovered in the field of view, but there's only three of them. Okay, so when your population statistics are limited. Okay, so this looks much better. Okay, now going away from the pointed instruments to an all-sky instrument, back to Fermi again. The very nice thing about Fermi now is that with many years of data and an improved analysis very recently, which boosts the collection area at high energies, the statistics above 50 GeV are pretty good, and you can do a lot. So above 50 GeV, Fermi now has 360 objects detected. 75% of them are active galaxies. Most of those are high energy beats, black objects. So then, the thing to bear in mind here is now instead of a bias towards the galactic plane, I have a bias away from the galactic plane because here the diffuse emission makes sense. Although in this energy, it's not possible. Okay, so definitely this is an extremely valuable resource for the kind of work we're talking about. This was also shown by Christopher, or a version of it. This is the what you see if you look where there aren't sources. This is the isotropic diffuse, the isotropic gamma ray background around energies of GeV, that we want to be. And there is a turnover in this, which is surely related to the opacity of the universe. So the source populations presumably continue, but they don't make the emission from these TeV sources at cosmic distances, mostly doesn't make it to the observer. Okay, so this rollover is consistent with expectations. You can model this with various source populations, and the conclusion is that most of it is from blazars and the HVLs, IGBLF type objects. Now, I want to talk a bit about puzzles associated with this figure, so if there is time at the end, I'll just finish. Okay, so the one bit of the TeV sky that has been well mapped is the galactic plane. Now, I know this is a bit off topic, but I just wanted to show you. This is an illustration of what you can do with the high statistics and good angular resolution, you can get ground-based instruments, which is much harder to do with Fermi. Okay, so Fermi has comparable resolution, but only at the highest energies of star or for most of the distance. So here you see a pretty rich population of objects, mainly the dominant contributors of pulsar with nebulae and supernova remnants. And this implies, of course, that normal star-forming galaxies should be TGV gamma ray sources as well. And they are, but so far, TGV energies at least, we only have a couple of nearby starburst galaxies to detect. Okay, so isotropically emitting sources obviously are much harder to see than the kind of beamed emission we see from the TGV blazars. If you're lucky enough, things are pointed straight out. Okay, so on my first slide, I showed you this instrument, which is a wide field of view instrument. Now, these things have certain disadvantages. Their background rejection power is more modest, the angular resolution is more modest, but they point at the whole sky or about the range of the sky all the time. Okay, because this thing is just detecting electromagnetic cascade particles that reach the ground rather than looking for Cherenkov photons produced in the air. This thing is in southern Mexico, quite high altitude. And these things make wide field maps. Now, the sensitivity historically was not particularly impressive, but this thing, it's only been complete about a year, and already in a few months of data, the thing starts to show a population of sources in the galactic plane with not the same angular resolution as the one I showed you from Hess, but achieved very rapidly with the partial. So watch this space, and I think the relevant thing here for us is that Hawk is an unbiased detector. It's getting us a sample of objects. Sort of bias, and we can really measure the duty cycle and the average power of these objects in a way that we can't using the imaging Cherenkov telescope. So, for example, these blue points are Hawk-like curve over 1 year for Markarian 421, nearby high energy peak blazar, and the little black points come from a single Cherenkov telescope on Parma, a small one called FACT. But this is about as good as you get for imaging telescopes, because you can have the moon is up, or the weather was bad, or you're looking at something else, and really report and get the average we have. So this is interesting. Now, of course, you can say, okay, well, let's take the Hawk sample of blazars as a population, but for the moment at least, there are only two objects where you can make these kind of light curves. Markarian 421 and Markarian 501, which kind of matching pair of very nearby redshift 0.03 blazars. Okay, but in the future, who knows? So, okay, now just a bit more on AGN. So, Stefan Wagner tomorrow will talk about all the gory details. So I don't want to say much, but just to sort of give you a couple of example spectral energy distributions. So this is the usual representation. You pick your units. Some of us like electron volts. If you're a radio astronomer, you like hertz. So 10 to the 27 hertz is a TeV. It's a useful thing to know. And of course, 10 to the 9 hertz down here is gigahertz. So these are radio points. Here is emission in the optical, X-ray, TeV. So the blue points were all measured as part on one month, as part of a sort of general multi-wavelength campaign. And the reason you need to measure all these different wavelengths at once is that these objects are highly variable. This one is an intermediate peaked VLAC object, so the peak in synchrotron emission is in the optical, and the peak gamma ray somewhere in the QV. But of course, this was just pre-Fermi. So you see, in the days of Egret, it was desperately hard to model these kind of SEVs because you didn't have good constraints around the GEV. So this is a real breakthrough with Fermi. But still, given my caveats about the sensitivity of Fermi on short timescales, we always have to be careful putting together these kind of spectral energy distributions from data that might have been taken on at different times. Now, a couple more of these things. This one is Mark Herring 41 again. Always we see these double peak spectra. This is completely dominated by non-thermal emission. This stuff is synchrotron emission. This stuff is usually attributed as inverse Compton emission. In this case, it's inverse Compton from electrons upscattered by synchrotron photons, which is called synchrotron self-Compton. And the remarkable thing for me about this is that this green line fits the data very well, is that it's an incredibly simple model. This is a single zone spherical blob with a certain Lorentz factor and a population of electrons. So given what we know about the complexity of jets in active galaxies, the fact that the simple models work is really remarkable. Except they don't always work, of course, and this is another example of a more distant object where now we see that the measured spectral energy distribution has a rapidly falling spectrum at the TeV energies. And the authors here are attempting to deabsorb this to cope with extragalactic background light absorption. And their deabsorbed spectrum has a sharp upturn. Okay. So there are a few examples like this. So this could be a new component in the spectrum. It could just mean that the absorption is wrong, our model of the extra background light is wrong. But this tells you that the picture is maybe not quite as simple as you might expect. Okay, so I wanted to say something, of course, about this EPL absorption. So first of all, because Christoph went through this part quite quickly. So first of all, what is the extragalactic background light? The range of wavelengths that we're talking about here is basically from the UV visible part, a few hundred nanometers, up to hundreds of microns, so the far infrared. And this thing has two big bumps in it. It has emission from stars, so a starlight, so hence the visible wavelengths here. Of course, it's the stars in all galaxies in the universe integrated over the life of the universe. So this is the light filling the spaces between galaxies. And then a second bump, which is essentially due to star, which has been reprocessed by dust. So this is thought to be dominated by star formation processes through the life of the universe. And you get these two big bumps. Now, the experimental situation here is horribly complex, hence this terrible diagram, and also the modeling situation. So these many curves are different galaxy evolution models, essentially. And historically, at least, there have been claims which were orders of magnitude away from what we now believe is the truth. So one of the difficulties is so-called zodiacal light, very nearby foreground light that messes up attempts to measure this. So you get lower limits from just counting galaxies. You can try and subtract foregrounds and make a measurement like that. But the thing is a bit of a mess. The TeV telescope stepped into this a decade or so ago, basically by saying that the models and the data that were out at the time, if we applied them, the deabsorbing of TeV spectra, we got completely crazy spectra. Okay. And then there was a mini industry of revising the models. And now we're in a situation that we have at least some self-consistent picture possible. So this is a threshold process, of course, right? The gamma-gamma pair production. I need enough energy in the rest frame to produce these two electrons. And so basically this bump of light limits the propagation of 200 GeV gamma rays. This low-energy photon background infrared can only be seen by something like 10 or 20 TeV gammas. Okay, so I have two steps in my absorption function, something that kicks in at sort of around 100 GeV and something that kicks in at higher energies. And if I model the intrinsic spectrum of blazars and I bin them into a few different bins of redshift, these are all nearby objects. This is taken a test. then I can look at the difference between my model, the intrinsic spectrum, which is basically anchored in the Fermi domain, and what I measure. Okay. And what you see in the smooth curves are the predictions of an EBR model and these evolution of galaxies models, which has been scaled to best match the data. The scaling factor here is a factor of 1.3, so one is not so bad somehow. And you see these two bumps associated with the two different bumps in the EBR, this one and this one. So this looks pretty self-consistent. Now, of course, there are objects that don't fit this paradigm very well, like the one I just showed you, and there's still room for maneuver in EBR, but at least it's a lot better understood now than it was a decade ago. Okay, and then of course these pairs can interact. So this is what Christoph was telling us, that the pairs may go on and inverse copy scatter on the cosmic microwave background. So I would expect GEV emission associated with every TEV source, and this is not seen. So this is a slightly different paper, but a similar argument to the one that Christoph showed. Essentially, the caveat here is that this conclusion rests on an assumption of the intrinsic spectrum. So if I have a higher spectrum in this domain, I can reduce my GEV demand. So this is one of the things I guess we'll hear tomorrow from Stefan about what kind of theoretical room we feel we have to play with on the intrinsic spectrum of these blazars. Assuming this intrinsic spectrum is right, is there anything else, of course, that can happen? So the two things that are considered here are magnetic deflections in intergalactic medium, which produce a halo around this thing, which is hard to detect experimentally, or some energy loss processes for the pairs. Now, the other most obvious thing is to say, well, the pairs lose energy by synchrotron emission, but then I need Gauss fields, micro-Gauss fields, so I need to be somewhere where. So the deflections are the easiest way just to get rid of these low energy electrons. But of course, as we're just hearing, there's another way for the pairs to lose their energy. Okay. Now, I just wanted to make one more remark about AGN in general, or these TEV blazars in particular, is that they're pretty remarkable objects in their own right, and not just as a way of heating up the universe. They exhibit really remarkable variability. So this little green dashed line is the normal quiescent state of this particular object, the TEV waveband. On one evening, over an hour or so, in 2006, this thing was 100 times brighter and varying on a few minute time scales. And a few minutes is basically 1% of the light crossing time of a supermassive black hole. So this is hard. Okay, if the thing is beating towards you, so you have some wiggle room to say this is not the real time scale, but I have Doppler boosting. But still, the thing is extremely hard. You need to invoke very, very high bulk motions of the stuff coming out of these objects. And recently, it's become clear that you get these short time scales also for some objects that don't have very small angles to the line of sight. So this thing, IC210, has got a radio jet that you can see, a very long one. So the viewing angle of the jet is not a degree. The authors of this paper at least claim it's at least 15 degrees, and you still see this extreme variability. So this has implications for the physics, but also, of course, the idea of how beamed are my beams? This is a question that you can ask. How beamed do we need the beams to be? For these plasmids and other things. Okay, so then I wanted to talk about the future, my remaining time. The current instruments will run a little bit longer, but probably only a little bit longer. Something like 2019, you should expect some or most of these detectors to be switched off. Hawk will be extended to boost its high energy sensitivity. fully, again, it may not last much longer than 20 or 18, depending on what NASA decides to do with it. It cannot lock me for a longer operation. And the problem in space is that no great new successor firmly is planned. Nobody has a smart idea. It's going to be a long, long time before the Fermi archive is not the best that we can do. Now, on the ground, so far we didn't spend that much money, relatively speaking, and the technologies are developing. So there's a lot more scope for improving things on the ground, and there are many major projects. CTA, which I'll talk about for most of the rest of the talk, probably there'll be something like Hawk in the Southern Hemisphere. There's something. Well, these pictures are just things that my group's working on, really biased. Summary. But LASSO is something focused. This is a big Chinese project. This is something focused on the higher energies. It's a very large area detector. The most relevant for this meeting is probably the central instrument here, which is like Hawk, but four times as big. So this will be a boost to sensitivity and collection area for northern objects from a few years from now, hopefully finishing 5 years. CTA is the main game in town. This is basically a joining together of the various efforts. All the people who built the Hess Magic and Veritas projects are involved in CTA. We now have a list of 31 countries supporting us. And the idea is to push basically on all aspects of the performance, build an observatory on two sites to get full sky coverage, and build a real observatory for the first time your team will work. So something where guest observers can write proposals, get their data in a format they can use, get user support, an open archive in the way there is now for film. Because it's better, but it's also more accessible than current instruments as well. Okay, we're prototyping now. We hope to build this thing starting next year. It will take quite a long time to build it, but the good thing is, with a very large number of Cherenkov telescopes, we plan, even when we've only built a small fraction of the array, it will already be significantly more powerful than the current instruments. So we'll start doing static science quite quickly. The two sites are almost fixed, so we're negotiating, and the final stages of negotiation with two sites. There should be one in La Palma, in Chile, Arenal. So this is basically next to the ESO VLT, quite close to the plants. That's what the ELT, the European Extreme Large Telescope, has been constructed here. It's about an hour, and here's where CTA should go. Okay. And the site in La Palma is basically where the current Magic telescopes go. So we hope by the summer that those site negotiations will be concluded, and that very soon after that we can start pouring some concrete. Okay, so what do we want to do with it? Well, I said we want to push on all aspects of performance. The thing, we'll have better angular resolution, much wider field of view, coverage to higher energies, better sensitivity, collection area, access to lower energies. And one of the interesting things here is to try and make this kind of EBL measurement from the absorption signature in blazar spectra. And by collecting a big population with a range of redshifts, we believe we can establish the normalization of the EBL, not just at redshift zero, but as a function of redshift, beyond redshift one. So this helps constrain people's models of galaxy evolution. Obviously, you'd like this to go to redshift 3, that's a bit hard. But over in the recent past, we can do it. The telescopes will be able to move quickly, so we can chase gamma ray bursts. And this is a simulated gamma ray burst with CTA. We'll get very high statistics when we catch these things. And we go to better energy resolution, which is good if you want to measure spectral features or look at dark matter annihilation patterns. The thing is, about an order of magnitude more sensitive than current detectors at a few TeV, which is, I guess, the place. which is very useful for the current discussion. Taking over from Fermi for steady sources at something like 50 to 100 GeV. And with a very wide energy range here, up to hundreds of TeV. And we get that by deploying different sizes of telescopes, so very large telescopes cover the low energy part, and small size telescopes in large numbers covering a large area on the ground give us the very high energy part. This is just an example measured spectrum over the orders of magnitude of energy. Okay, so this was the casual rings of these things have existed for quite a long time. The nice thing for me at least is to see photographs of these things. These are all prototype telescopes of various kinds. The thing exists now because we haven't started building on the final site. We start to have a very good idea of what we want to build. And just before Christmas, we got our first Cherenkov images. This is just a movie. The time steps here are 1 nanosecond long. So this is a flash of Cherenkov light in the Earth's atmosphere measured in this Cherenkov camera, in this prototype small-size telescope. And this thing is built at the Observatoire de Paris, Paris, of course. And the main lesson so far is that it's not a good idea to build a Cherenkov telescope in the City of Lights. for engineering tests, this was fun. Okay, so what time have I got?
3 minutes.
Okay, good. So I can just make it if I go fast. So I don't want to talk about all the different science you can do in CTA, just to point out that we have the word feedback here appears in our official blurb. So somehow this is a great relevance to CTA, ways in which TeV particles and TeV photons feedback on the universe and their systems. Understanding how jets and relativistic outflows work clearly is part of it, and also some frontier stuff like trying to find annihilation signature of dark matter, looking for elements of Lorentz violation, predicted in some quantum gravity frameworks, etc., etc. So CTA will have significantly better angular resolution than current detectors. This is maybe indirectly of relevance here because it gives us the chance to resolve extragalactic objects for the first time. The current instruments can see things in our galaxy resolved, but not extragalactic things. Of course, we'll never be resolving blazars, but if I take SEN-A, which was also an example shown by Christoph, the giant radio lobes of SEN-A are resolved by Fermi. In Hess, at the moment, the TV detectors see a point-like source consistent with the center of this thing with a big error bar. With CTA, we've got a big enough field of view that we can look at the whole system, including these giant radio lobes, so the full moons, like this big, but also have the resolution of a couple of arc minutes such that we can clearly resolve all the different parts of the system, including the core and the inner part of the jet, of course, the very, very good part of the jet, and establish the centroid of the emission a lot more accurately than that. So there could be, or there should be, insights from nearby active galaxies that can help us understand these more distant systems that we need to do the heating. Okay, this was basically my point about the limited capability of Fermi Lab at short timescales. Here, if you integrate for 10 years, Fermi is as good as CTA at 50 GeV. But if you look on a minute timescale, or even an hour timescale, you've got 4 orders of magnitude gain by using the Cherenkov telescope. This is really the way to do it for any variability short timescales. Okay, I don't really have time to say anything about dark matter, except that we have a real chance to detect it. Okay, so finally, back to what will CTA do for AGN? So We will detect clearly a bigger population of active galaxies. You can spend a lot of time trying to work out how many. Clearly, it's going to be something like an order of magnitude more compared to our current 65. Predictions have been made by various people for this quarter sky survey that we plan to make at CTA. We will get a biggish sample from TOOs, but there'll be probably the biggest single population will come from serendipitous detections in the wide field. Okay, so I said in the current detectors, this is a small fraction. The difference here is the field of view is much bigger and the sensitivity is much higher. So we expect that in the end, this will be a dominant population. Of course, this is, in a sense, unbiased. So if you exclude the object you choose to point at, the rest of the field of view is fair game. So there will be a big population. It will be possible to do population studies with it. And it will be mostly high energy objects. As well as more objects, there'll be better measurements of the spectra. These are some simulated spectra of a few objects measured with CTA over wide energy range. You can see in these the kind of absorption features that I was pointing to before. And if you want to understand how big a step that is from where we are now, this is just overlaying the Veritas spectrum for this particular object as it is now. Okay, so we go from this blue set of points from these grey points here. This is just the deabsorbed version of the same spectrum. These grey points are something like the blue points. Okay. So this is really a huge step in quality. It will enable us to get rid of a lot of these ambiguities between intrinsic spectra and absorption features. Okay, and finally, CTA will have some direct handles on cascading. Clearly, if we need to chase low luminosity objects in order to see these things, if the pair heating works out, then it helps to have a more sensitive instrument. But basically, we will look using the improved angular resolution and sensitivity of CTA for extended emission away from the central source in the with the wide energy range of CTA. So it's really a huge boost in the ability to detect halos. This is a picture, by the way, showing individual photons with circle sizes, which tell you about their energy. So the high energy ones are in the middle, the low energy ones are deflected into galactic fields. And here you need something like 10 to the minus 40 Gauss to get things spread out on degree scales for a nearby object. Okay, the other thing we can do is look for tiny magnetic fields. Even if I see still a point like source, it could be that I have small path length differences caused by the pair conversion and subsequent emission, which will lead to a time delay of the GeV photons reaching it. So if I can measure wideband spectra with many time steps, I have a chance to be involved there. What you will be looking for is basically a lack of variability in the or potentially some real echo of a flare simulator in the energy band. Okay, so all this will be written up in a document that you'll be able to read very soon. And I just wanted to conclude by saying that things are improving very rapidly in terms of our observational understanding of the Galileo sky. And that CTA, I think, is the instrument that will be most helpful from the gamma ray observational side for the topic that happened in the fair in the future.
So while we go through some questions, Matt, if I get you set up.
Sure.
I'm going to use session chair prerogative and ask the first one. You're talking about the sub-processing time, sub-processing time variability in TV sources. So it's the acceleration model. That's not at all time-set, right? So you open up, the gas will fill the fairly small scales, and that will set the time scale of the instability coming down.
To get down, I mean, the trick sometimes is you need quite a high luminosity. You can't, anything that's not using a reasonable fraction of the object is something that works. So I think the challenge is, yeah, you can put things very close to the black hole, which obviously helps. And you can test about the Doppler factors, but anything that you do, if you do something with variability and accretion disk, you can't cheat with the big dollar factor, because this is the transfer, which is a critical system. So,
absolutely trying to reduce an accretion disk with a non-starter.
This is based on the very simple model.